You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
To speak about the mobilization of the Honduran people, we've contacted Steve Stewart. Steve is the program director for the Vancouver-based solidarity organization Co-Development Canada. He was part of an international delegation to Honduras from September 5th to 11th, and so has had firsthand experience of developments in that country. Good morning, Steve, and welcome to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
How extensive are the popular mobilizations against the coup?
If they were, well, I was down there quite extensive. I was there from the 5th to the 11th of September, and at that time there was it's a bit of a lull in the level of repression, in that there had been heavy crackdowns in August, and it had sort of eased off a bit until last week. But we ended up participating in one march that wasn't huge. It was on maybe 5,000 people, but still fairly large. It went on for hours and hours, and we thought that was sort of, you know, we were lucky to have arrived on the day that there was a march. We found out the next day that that was just their daily march in Tegucigalpa, that every single day they had a similar march going to different parts of the city. And we found out later still from others in other cities that these marches went on daily in many of the cities in the country.
I had heard at some point that there were, in addition to marches, people blockading roads and, in a sense, putting a stall to some of the economic activity of the country. Is there truth to that?
In August, there was a lot of roadblocks. They were very violently repressed. There was a lot of people injured, many people jailed. Thousands of people jailed, and a number of people killed. That sort of forced a change of tactics on the part of the protesters. However, a lot of the sort of hindrance with the economic activities has been carried out by the coup government itself, because when there are large mobilizations, they shut down the airports, close the borders, block the roads themselves to prevent protesters from getting to the capital. Many people come from their villages into town. So quite often, all you need to do is march and you shut down all the economic activity because the army sets up the roadblocks.
When there are these demonstrations in different parts of the country or even in the city, are they coordinated, or is there kind of a unified organization which tries to decide on tactics that they think will be most effective, or is it quite spontaneous and uncoordinated?
No, since the day after the coup, sort of coalition was created called the National Resistance Front Against the Coup, which is sort of known by everyone in Honduras simply as the Resistance. It started originally kind of ad hoc, made up of a sort of coordination of representatives of the major organizations, the Campesino movement, the indigenous peoples, the women, the youth. Each one sort of had their section. While we were there, we attended the formal founding of the Resistance Front, which brought in about 500 delegates from all 18 of the provinces, and they spend a great deal of time debating the structures and decision-making process, and by the end of that assembly, they had sort of created a national organization that was there for the long haul. In some ways, Micheletes let the genie out of the bottle when he carried out the coup, in that Honduras will not go back to the way it was. Whether or not the coup ends or not, the Resistance Front is looking to refund the country, refound the country, pardon me.
Maybe that brings up to mind then, what kind of goals or demands are these popular mobilizations struggling for?
Well, the original motivation, or at least the excuse given by the coup leaders for carrying out the coup, was that Zelaya was holding a sort of public opinion poll about whether people were in favor of adding up a referendum to the November 29th general elections to ask people if they wanted to hold create a constituent assembly to write a new constitution for the country. Since the coup, it's become sort of much more polarized in the country and class lines much more clearly defined. And so the demands that you see everywhere, painted everywhere, and in the chants of the marchers, is to go straight to a constituent assembly. It's kind of with Zelaya or without Zelaya. What they want is to immediately elect a constituent assembly that will write a new constitution for the country.
And is this seems to be part of a tactic that began in Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador, where people reconstruct their constitutions in ways that allow for greater participation and more social progressive changes. Is that the sort of inspiration for Honduras as well?
Yeah, the current Honduran constitution was written under the military dictatorship in the early 80s, and so it doesn't contemplate much participation on the part of the population, and people have been inspired by seeing the sort of shifts in the power balance after the constituent assemblies in Ecuador, Bolivia, and Venezuela, and hope that if they hold this, create a new constitution that it may lead them that, in the same direction. That's also what the people who carried out the coup fear, is that if they open it up to the people to rewrite it, the rules would change a lot.
You referred earlier to repression from the army and police. How would you characterize that repression? Is it an effort to really gun down masses of people to prevent or destroy the momentum? Is it something that comes more intensely at some moments and then backs off and so on? What sort of strategy are the coup makers pursuing, if there is any consistent strategy?
It has come in waves. Initially, the repression was more selective. But when it was clear there was such a huge upswell of hundreds of thousands of people in the streets calling for the return of Zelaya, it has tended to be accelerated at certain times. Generally, when Zelaya has attempted to return, thousands of people have mobilized to support him, and that's when the crackdowns have been hardest. The most dangerous period, I believe, was when President Zelaya surprisingly, at least for the coup government, returned to the capital the week before last. At that point, it seemed almost as though the repression were a panicked reaction for part of the coup leadership, in that it was fairly wholesale, almost random violence, hundreds of people detained and taken to be held in the sports stadiums because there was no room for them in the jails. And curfews extended 24 hours, which made it possible for them to detain anyone, and the military and police going into the poor neighborhoods and literally hunting particularly young people that they spotted on the streets. It didn't seem to have a focus except for to create a state of general terror on the part of the population, which may have been the objective, in that it did manage by the end of by the middle of last week to stifle a lot of the street protests.
The coup makers seem to have been in a bit of a they've closed themselves in. On the one hand, they've declared this sort of state of emergency, and at the same time they want to hold elections that try to legitimate, I guess, their coup in November. Is there a coherent plan, does it seem to you, or is it something that they're improvising because things have not worked out the way they had hoped?
Yeah, I think things have not worked out the way they hoped. They had expected the situation to sort of be resolved. They and the people that worked with them at the international level, the situation to be resolved fairly quickly. I think also the surprise return of Celaya kind of messed up their game plan. As long as he was outside the country, they could just use delaying tactics and hope that the November 29th elections would resolve everything. With the return of Celaya, the coup government began to act much more erratically. One was this declaration of 45-day state of siege for the entire country, where all civil rights were suspended. They moved against, they banned all street demonstrations or all street gatherings, period. They moved to shut down the last remaining media that were not loyal to the coup. But I think they may have not really thought about what the longer-term consequences of that, in that they had been gambling on trying to make the elections legitimize the coup in the international community. So since that declaration of the 45-day state of siege, there's been cracks, or at least criticisms, appearing in the coup coalition, with some business and military sectors calling on the president to revoke that 45-day state of emergency. At the same time, they've invited the Organization of American States to come in to sort of mediate debate. When the OAS officials arrived, they deported them. Then the next day they turned around and said, no, we want you to come back. So they do seem to be behaving quite erratically in the last week and a half or so.
How would you characterize the behavior of our government in relation to the coup?
I wouldn't say it's erratic. They have been fairly steadfastly, trying to mitigate the negative effects of the coup, shall we say. Of all the countries in the Americas, Canada is the only one that maintains military and direct bilateral aid to the coup leadership. At the same time, in its international statements, while the Canadian government has sort of said they wish the coup didn't happen, they've also said that they kind of believe that there was valid reasons behind the coup. So they've sort of acted very strongly as apologists for the coup. Last week at the Organization of American States General Assembly, where there was to be a vote to say that the members of the Organization of American States will not recognize elections held under the military regime, Canada was one of, I believe, four countries that blocked that resolution.
What would you say we can do in response both to our government's policies and in support of democratic process in Honduras?
I think the key thing right now is to try and pressure the Canadian government. As I said, it's one of the very few friends that the coup government has around the world. The United Nations General Assembly has condemned the coup. The Organization of American States, virtually all the countries of Latin America, even the right-wing governments. So pressuring the Canadian government to publicly declare that there will be no recognition of elections held under the military dictatorship is a key way to sort of let the coup leadership know that they need to talk, that they can't just ride this out to the end of November. The other one is to pressure the Canadian government to join with many other nations that are calling for the coup leaders to be indicted in the International Criminal Court because of widespread violations. This is something that the people in the resistance front feel will help ease off on the repression, because when the Inter-American Human Rights Commission was down there, they did ease off in that they saw what happened to Pinochet, never tried but no longer able to travel, and that's something they felt really frightens the elites that are behind the coup.
Well, thank you very much for taking time this morning to give us an update and the description of the situation on the grassroots level of the Honduran struggle. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. I would just like to add that people can send letters by email to the Canadian government if they go onto our website at codev.org, and there they'll find links that will enable them to quickly send letters to Stephen Harper and the opposition parties.
Oh, thanks very much for that, and I'll repeat that again. Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Steve Stewart. He's program director for the Vancouver-based solidarity organization, Co-Development Canada. And as he said, you can send letters by going on to that organization's website, codev.org.